I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is Meet the CIO, the monthly show from Tech Central, where we talk not to technology vendors, but rather to the end user customers of IT, the banks, manufacturers, retailers, and other companies and industries that are using modern technology to drive their strategic agenda. Now, Meet the CIO is brought to you by Wipro, and we thank the team at Wipro for helping us bring you these great interviews. You can learn more about Wipro at wipro.com. Do go and check them out. Now, our guest in episode 4 of Meet the CIO is also our first non-banker on the show. Jose Suarez is Director of IT at the Capital Hotels, Apartments and Resorts, and he's particularly excited about the role that AI can play in the hospitality industry. So I'm excited to learn more about that. But first of all, Jose, thanks for making the time and welcome to Meet the CIO.
Thank you, Duncan. Thank you. It's awesome to be here. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Well, it's great to have you. Jose, one of the first questions I always ask my guests on the show is how they got into IT. We had Bruce Paveley from Time Bank as our first guest, and he told us about his, I think it was a ZX81, actually. It was his first computer. He learned how to program on it, et cetera, et cetera. What was your first exposure to tech, and did it influence your career?
Oh, 100%. And sadly, I started on the ZX81 too.
You did?
No programming, though. Okay. That's why you'll see later on in my career, I had this big thing for gaming. It was pure gaming and pure joy derived from that, because my dad was a bit of a techie, you know, and he was really like, he loved it. So he would bring home ZX81, then it was the Commodore 64, then we got a Nintendo, then we got a, you know, monochrome Hercules and a 286 and a 386. I went through the entire evolution.
Right.
But it was games. It was purely about
gaming.
Games.
Okay.
Games. And I watched that, you know, go from dots and lines to, you know, what it is today, 3D yeah. immersion. You know,
so
it's been from there it was the, you know, the Apple. I bit off the Apple and I just couldn't stop.
Oh, did you? What was your first Apple?
No, I actually never owned an Apple.
Oh, you didn't?
No, my first is I don't go any further than an iPhone.
Okay.
And because I don't want to offend anybody, you know, because there's always that big argument in the IT department.
Yes.
I'll just leave it at that. I stayed purely a PC man.
Oh, you have. Okay, yes, see, Windows, yes. but an iPhone.
But an iPhone. They do the phone really well.
Okay. And that ZX81, did you also type in the games from computer magazines and...
Yeah.
It was a laborious process of saving it to cassette tape to be able to load the games and play them.
The ZX81 I was maybe a little bit too young, so that was more being driven by my father. But when we got to the Commodore 64, because it had a very similar process, your tape deck, pop it in, then you had all the command lines, and you used to sit there and you would run it, and it would load up. We even had, and I can't remember the name of the game, but it would let you build your own kind of small mini games and that, and it would take hours, because you can imagine on something that had 64Ks of RAM, just how long the process was. But geez, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change it for a thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing how far we've come in.
Incredible.
What's it been, 40, 45 years since the ZX81 came out? Yeah.
Makes me feel old. The grays.
I'm also old. I also used one of those when I was a kid. But how long have you been with the Capital Hotels Group now?
It would be just shy of about 6 years now. So I think next year will be 6 years.
6 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Five years.
Tell us a little bit about your career. I believe that you at one stage co-founded a mobile gaming company. Was that your first
stint? That's the first. Well, I had a previous job before that, but I've had many jobs prior to that, but
okay.
You know, waitering and running restaurants and those types of things.
Right.
You know, don't put them on the CV. People don't really tend to care for them. But I had a small web development job prior where it was basically the equivalent of slave labor, because I was getting paid nothing and doing copious amounts of coding.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good.
Learning.
Because I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a friend of mine at varsity who stayed on to do his honors. And then he phoned me up one day and he said, listen, I'm going to take that idea that I was throwing around at varsity. I'm going to go with it. You're interested? And at that time, my salary had just gone, you know, double digits. So I was like, no, I'm living the real life here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm cushy where I am. Week or two later, I thought about it and I thought, you know what, no. Let's give this a bash. And we went straight into building mobile games, which was where I actually wanted to be, was in the gaming industry.
When was this?
This is 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, 2006 going into 2007.
So this was pre-iPhone.
This is pre-iPhone. This is why the story is so better for me, because we really had an incredible thing going there. So basically what we had come up with was social mobile gaming. Sounds so familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
advertising ingested into the game to monetize it. And then players would play against each other and rank and win prizes, you know, all within the context of a social network, which didn't actually exist as it was or as it is today. And I think we were just before the wave, you know, came, and we unfortunately got distracted with other opportunities, and the whole gaming thing got shut down. We were doing incredibly well. I mean, one of our best achievements in that space is, I don't know if you recall, there was a company called AdMob, and AdMob used to do the mobile advertising.
They were bought by Google.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. That's right. Mm. So we got this weird email. We got contacted by this company called AdMob, because obviously what we had started doing is putting the advertising into these games. No one had done this before, because all of a sudden you had advertising, because you've got to understand the amount of time someone spends in a game, so the amount of ads you're serving through this whole thing. And I mean, you've got to think about this. This is like a Samsung D600 flip phone.
Yes.
And we've got banner ads inside of this thing. No one's done this before. And the advertising's flipping and it's going crazy. And then all of a sudden we got contacted with these guys, and they were like blown away by what we were doing, because nobody else was doing this. And this was, you know, as we see today, right? It became such a pervasive thing. But we unfortunately got distracted by making money, because we were making no money at that time, unfortunately. And then we got contacted to do app development.
Okay.
And, you know, that started to pay. Yeah, that starts to pay. And, you know, as young guys, you need a little bit of money to get your career and your life going. So,
what was the game called?
Oh, we had lots.
Did you?
Okay. Yeah. We had a Dr. Kumalo game, funny enough. We tried to do something with him, never got off the ground. Then we had a zombie game. We had a Tetris clone. Stack Attack. I mean, they used to distribute it. We had a short code, so you would dial the short code, you would download the game and get the JAR or JAR file and open it up on your phone. And we used to have 30, 40, 50 different devices around the office, because you had to test and you had to build it individually. I mean,
For each phone.
It was...
There was no standard operating system back
none.
Then.
None. Mm-hmm. That's actually where I got stuck into graphics, believe it or not. So I came in and I was a software engineer by... having gone done about BSc IT, I'd been programming, very web orientated.
Okay.
But I've got this thing for design. I've always had this thing for design. And you know how it happens. You're three guys in the office drawing straws. Who can do any pictures? So I put my hand up and I said, I'll do some pictures. And I started doing pixel art and all kinds of things. Okay. That's where I blame the glasses. Because that
too much
time on that small screen, painting everything in dots, and you know. Now I wear these things for a living. Oh, but you know, it's a great experience, because I'm always trying to do something different.
Yeah. Okay. Did you always see yourself heading into the tech space when you were a kid?
No.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
So, the moment was I got to the end of high school. So I had the privilege of getting to the end of high school. I was a year younger. So I graduated at 17.
Okay.
So for some reason in the back of my mind, that meant I had time, right? And my two brothers prior to me had gone straight into varsity. You know, that's the formula. You know, your parents tell you, you know, it's you go to school, you go to university, and so forth. You follow the formula. I got to the end of it, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I still remember having those sessions with my parents, because I didn't know where I was going to go with this. IT was in the back of my mind, but it wasn't what it is today. You know? And I wanted to get into gaming, and to get into that industry in South Africa, didn't exist. You had to get on a plane, hop, and be somewhere of significance. So when I left, I was working in restaurants. My family's all came from restaurants. Mm-hmm. So I waited and managed and did all kinds of things. And during that time, I had another love, which was airplanes.
Okay.
And I wanted to become a pilot. And I actually tried twice because SAA at the time had like a whole program that you would apply to, and you would go through a series of checks and medicals and whatnot. And I got so far each time. But, you know, the criteria, I mean, it was a big group of guys, and then it would be almost smooshed down to 10, 11, 12. And then the two times I never kind of made it, you know. So I just carried on going in the restaurant thing. And eventually, 2-3 years into that, I was there the one night, and there was one of the waiters there. And I think the guy must have been probably about my age now as a waiter. And I just, you know, I kind of thought to myself, am I heading in this direction? This is where I want to be, because it was comfortable. You know, my family's had been in restaurants. It kind of felt like maybe I should get into this space. And then at that point, I said, no, this isn't what I wanted to do. And I went back to that other love of mine, had a chat with my dad, and I said, listen, you know, I'm going to go back.
It sounded like he was very into tech. I mean, he's buying all these computers.
My father, you know what, I have to, I always do, and I always say it to him, if it wasn't for, didn't ram it down our throats.
Yeah.
But he, you know, we were so lucky because it was there.
Yes.
You know, it was really there. I mean, I knew things in school that no one else knew, mm-hmm. you know. And I had my own little software piracy syndicate, which is to my shame, because I think, you know, back in the days when you were zipping and sharing computer games on stiffy disks in wads like this, I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
I felt quite bad about that, but, you know, it was the past, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that moment was like the aha. I went back.
Yes.
I went back and said, you know, let's give this a go. But, you know, because my schooling had been pretty much average.
Yeah.
I wasn't very interested in school. I was mm-hmm. interested in the girls, and I was interested in rugby and gym. That okay. was about it.
And computer games.
Definitely computer games.
Yeah. What was your favorite game when you were growing up?
I was into the Sierras. I don't know if you know the Sierra.
I know the Sierras
and,
well,
and LucasArts.
Yeah.
So it was point and click adventures.
King's Quest, Space Quest.
Yeah. Oh, Space yeah. Quest.
Mm-hmm.
I still played, I think, one... maybe 4 or 5 years ago, just okay. for good odds. Yeah.
Still, I love them as well.
We'll still kicks my ass because yeah. still some points I can't remember.
yeah, lots of they were fun, insanely yeah. difficult.
Very difficult. Yeah. Very, very difficult. Yeah.
Fascinating. But it's brilliantly done at the time. So you got involved in this startup, obviously eventually moved on from that. Is that when you joined NetOne?
So what happened is... whilst we were doing applications, because we did a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
So we actually started working for telcos and doing work with telcos, doing value-added services. So we used to run what's called a mega promo, which okay. you would have seen. You're a VAS provider. You would go and you'd provide the VAS service and people would SMS. And because we were gaming, it felt like, you know, that's what we did. And we got approached to do it. And we said, okay, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And we actually started one up in Namibia called Mula Mobile,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be the equivalent of the state lottery.
Okay.
So we were running this lottery as this unofficial lottery, and getting that exposure. And then we did a lot of work with other telcos all mm-hmm. throughout Africa doing a very similar thing. And whilst we were doing that, we then got approached by NetOne
right.
to start taking some of what we had learned there and the application and building out their mobile side of the business and creating fintech applications and the rest of it. And we got stuck into one app of theirs, which was called VC Pay,
mm-hmm.
which created virtual cards. And that came over and became our little baby. And obviously in that process, they realized, you know, look, we don't have this department. We don't have these skills. We don't have this young, hungry bunch of guys, you know, let's bring them over. And they gave us an offer that was incredible, you know, and we're young and we, this is the place to go. And off we went and we got absorbed into the group and we absorbed all of what they were doing at the time, you know, and that's, you know, that was the exposure to the banking industry because mm-hmm. we got involved in every shape and form, whether they were doing the grant, because I remember at that time, I know there's a lot of background history on it, but we got involved in that whole process and assisted and built in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was over a course of 10 years, let's okay. call it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I learned the banking system, exchange and the rest of it. It was nice.
Okay.
Very, very nice. And I even took a little bit of a turn in my career and started doing marketing, believe it or not.
Huh?
Yeah. Okay. If an opportunity comes my way, I don't know if it's to my own detriment, but I seem to just lap it up and go, you know, what the hell?
Yeah.
What's to lose?
Yeah, for sure. So tell us about after NetOne and how you eventually came to the Capital
perfect,
Hotels
perfect.
Group.
So obviously we decided at some point, because myself, the guys, the original founding members of the group, we decided, you know, NetOne was going in a direction that wasn't really for us. We decided to leave, all went off in our different directions. I then spent probably about a year, maybe a little bit more, in a consultancy basis. Again, because we had done all the other work across the telcos doing lotteries and that, we got approached to try and look at spinning up a couple of lotteries in Mozambique, in Angola, in Swaziland as well. So I spent a year working on those projects and doing some private projects where I was consulting on software development, marketing, a mix of it. And somewhere towards the end of that tenure, I got approached by, I can't remember, the recruitment agency, and they said, look, there's this hotel company, they're very, very kind of entrepreneurial. They're really looking for something different. And we think you're the right thing, because they had been struggling to find this unicorn, because they didn't want an IT guy. They wanted an idiot like me that had decided to do every single job he could find in his career, you know, who could come in and, you know, shake things up. And
someone with a wide experience that get into every part of the business.
Correct. Yeah. And they don't typically like taking the kind of the formulaic hotelier person, because the thinking is very shaped by the studies, very shaped by the processes, bringing this outward thinking. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, I thought, you know what, I wasn't not going anywhere, but it, you know, there's no definitive path or route. And I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And my timing was spectacular. Do you know why?
COVID?
Yeah, 6 months.
How did I guess?
It was amazing. I still remember having that phone call with my past colleagues, and I just said to them, yeah, guys, I've chosen wisely. I went to my wife and I said, I think I've made the big one, the big mistake now. But I was lucky.
Yeah.
I was lucky in the fact that I had arrived in an incredible group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, our CEO and the basis of the business is built on such a foundation of being shrewd when it comes to saving, shrewd when it comes to money, and preparing.
Mm-hmm.
Preparing always is something I could have probably taken in my own life, in my own personal aspects. But, you know, preparing for the bad times, because the bad times are where good opportunities are made.
I guess preparing for COVID is almost impossible.
Yes.
But and no one saw it coming.
100%. But at least we had the stamina to outlast a lot of the competition. I mean, hotels were downsizing left and right. You know, and that gave us the upper hand, because when we came out of COVID, we hadn't closed the door.
Yes.
We had barely gotten rid of any staff. Where now all the other hotel groups had to go and hire up and mm-hmm. open up, and those costs and those slowing down of process, we were just,
mm-hmm.
well, we weren't going the way the graph wants to go, but we were at least moving, you know. Mm-hmm. And in that time as well, I got to do a lot of, because it was quieter.
Yeah.
I got to do a lot of the thinking. A lot of the
thinking.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the groundwork of what we've laid now.
Okay. Before we carry on, tell me a bit about the group. Who owns it? What properties does it own? What's its target market?
Okay. So the business was started by Mark Waxberger, who's our CEO.
Mm-hmm.
He was, at the time when I came into the business, running the business completely on the ground. It's now got Yuri Bezadenot, who's come in as the managing director. Okay. And Mark has now taken, obviously, a more strategic role in trying to get the business to scale. The capital is a hotel group, and we are based across the nation. We have 12 hotels in total, spanning Durban, Cape Town, Nelspruit or Mpumalanga, and Gauteng. We've got the greatest concentration in Gauteng, with 5 being in the Sandton Node, 2 being in Pretoria, and then we've got a beautiful property up, which I mentioned, in Mpumalanga, and some nice ones down in Durban as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is it aimed mainly at business travelers?
It is historically. So we were talking about the name of the business now, it's the Capital Hotels, Apartments and Resorts.
Yes.
Okay, the resorts portion came in because, coincidentally, like I was referring to during COVID, where there was an opportunity to expand because there were a lot of distressed property.
Mm.
And we picked up some amazing assets like Zimbali,
mm-hmm.
and the 15 on Orange in Cape Town. And those brought a resort feel into the business, because prior to that, it had been predominantly focused at a business traveler's market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why you've got the apartment, because it's that longer term, I'm traveling, I need a kitchen,
right.
I need amenities. You know, the spaces are beautiful.
Gorgeous. Someone who comes in on a 6-month contract from overseas, for example.
100%. Okay. We have a lot of that. We have a lot of that. You know, and the guys are traveling and they need to have spaces which are functional, with washing machines and dishwashers and the rest of it. And that was predominantly what the basis of the market. Since then, it's obviously expanded into being and having this resort feel, and not only in those coastal regions, also inland. And, you know, because people do sometimes take, you know, time out, whether in Sandton or whether you just drive up to Mpumalanga. I mean, Mpumalanga is beautiful. I don't know if you've obviously been that side. I mean, the landscape and everything.
Yeah.
And then you can go out during the day and explore it and come back to the stunning hotel in the middle of Nelspruit.
Do you have one hotel or resort that's your premier destination that sort of supersedes the rest?
Or
if there isn't one, are there two or three that...
There's two or three, because I think if any of the GMs are listening and anyone
at the office,
I'm going to get into trouble here, because it's like picking favorite children, right? You know, standout-ish ones, obviously, Zimbali's a big one. I mean, that property is gorgeous, built during...
Magnificent.
Mm. Built for the 2010 Soccer World Cup. It was originally done by the Fairmont Group. Mm. So you've got, you know, stunning floors and high ceilings that are 3 or 4 or 5 meters. You can imagine mounting a Wi-Fi AP up there. It's quite a feat, but a very different. Then you've got the 15 on Orange, which was also a Marriott. Beautiful, beautiful, stunning property right there in Gardens. And our own, which we've built, which is the Capitol and Park, which is this magnificent 300-room business apartment / you know, conferencing space right in the heart of Sandton. Mm-hmm. So there's many. And in Pretoria, and in, you know, if anyone's listening, you know, guys, they're all amazing.
Okay. So, Jose, I've just recently been booking accommodation for my year-end break this year, and I'm amazed you can just do everything online now, and it's so convenient. You don't have to speak to call center agents. It's just you do your research online, you book online, you pay online. Everything happens online. It's all very well integrated. Maybe take us through how IT has transformed the hospitality industry over the last 5 to 10 years, and what's that? What that has meant for groups like yours, who no doubt have had to do quite a lot of work in terms of infusing technology throughout everything you do. Maybe take us through what your IT stack looks like now compared to when you joined 6 years ago.
Yeah,
and with the, you know, and what impact the internet and technology more broadly has had on the hospitality and tourism sector.
Okay, so. I'm not sure how far back we want to go, but I mean, let's say the somewhere between 5 years to a decade, right? Mm-hmm. So in that space, you'll find that hotels traditionally very procedural, operation intensive spaces, lots of people, right? And all these processes very paper driven, very SOPs, you know, thousands, even. Much to my dismay, there's still too many, okay? But you need them given the volume of functions that a hotel performs. You know, it's not just a place where people sleep. It's a restaurant. Mm. It's a conference space. It's a place where people play. It's music going on. There's a kitchen. You know, there's a whole dynamic, a whole mishmash of things there. What it's fundamentally, obviously, internet, if we go through internet, what has internet done? Internet has changed the way the outside world engages with the hotel, right? So the big changes over that time have been, how have people booked? You know, if you think about it, back in the day, it was somebody phoning a travel agent or someone phoning some kind of register that would then contact and get a hold of the hotel. Now you've got your hotels fighting for viewership online, in the public domain, Google Hotels putting out their Booking.com, Agoda, Expedia, etc.
Airbnb.
So you've got this immense digital land grab going out there, trying to get your property out there, trying to integrate that mass of messages coming from all these third-party systems back into your own system that manages now the inventory and all of that. So the big changes have been in those spaces have obviously been in aggregating that information into solid systems, and a transition from being on-prem into a SaaS-based or a cloud-based model. Mm-hmm. And there's still many hotels, believe it or not, many, that are still running on-prem systems, just purely because in some regard, there's just so much technical debt here to shift it across is quite a significant amount of work for the hotel itself.
Does that put them at a competitive disadvantage?
The transition there is obviously, you know, to get that working is you've got all these outliers, all these third-party platforms need to talk then to your own platform. And a lot of the hotel groups are still on-prem. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the big shifts when I came in. We still obviously had a lot of on-prems items. And my big shift since then has been moving everything out of that, removing all of that, going into SaaS-based platforms, moving onto the cloud, building our own platforms. Does it put some of the other hotels at a disadvantage? Not immediately right now, because a lot of these platform providers, these PMSs as we call them, so your property management software, they've done a lot of work to ensure that the nicer technology, the newer technology, can interface
through some sort of middleware.
Yes, but the problem is that interface is horrific.
Oh, really?
Horrific. So it's a huge amount of work, and there's an inaccuracy inside of there. You speak to anybody within the industry, they'll tell you their pet hate is doing any type of integration. Mm-hmm. It's not as agile. You know, I came from a space where APIs and being able to consume and talk about an integration with a third-party platform, it's you go online, you see the documentation, have one or two meetings, and off you go. This is certification and documentation, getting approval and testing, and months and months and months before you get anywhere. So it does put them at a disadvantage mm-hmm. in that regard. And they're going to need to move, because a lot of the other platforms, these are going to start getting sunsetted as well, which means the features are going to start to diminish. Mm-hmm. There is massive work being done in terms of changing that already.
Yeah. Okay, so the whole industry is moving that way. Definitely. It's just that some are behind because of all the legacy they've got to deal with.
100%. And you've got to remember that in some instances you don't have internet like we have, so they need an on-prem solution.
Yes.
So maybe there's still a world where that might still need to exist for a long longer than what we now feel it needs to.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see the platform businesses like Airbnb as an opportunity or a threat?
It could be an opportunity. It's not exactly our market.
Okay.
Not exactly. So we don't, you know what I mean, because the type of inventory that we're selling, we're not really selling it on a Airbnb.
Okay. It's more a consumer retail.
It's more a consumer retail in the space mm-hmm. of it. You know, it's somebody else who's trying to get their, you know, I own this building, I own this room, I'm trying to get on there. But funny enough, we do have, so because the hotels, the way our hotels work, it's a mixed model. So let's take an example like Park, right? Mm-hmm. Park is 300 rooms-ish. Those rooms are made up of ones owned by residents who live there, people that have bought it, and then we become the managing agent and lease it.
Right.
People that own it themselves and then lease it themselves. And that could go onto an Airbnb. So not all the hotels, but some of them are built like that. Funny enough, that model, ironically, was the model in COVID that actually helped us tremendously.
Okay.
Because what happened during that time is we just said, take back your, we're not responsible for managing, take back your units,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that helped us there, because obviously that financial strain then became the owners, you know, we didn't have the responsibility because mm-hmm. we couldn't rent it out mm-hmm. at the time.
Okay. So take me through some of the big projects you've been involved in at the Capital Group. What have been the biggest since you joined, and what does your technology stack look like today?
Oh, too many things.
Okay.
It's far too many things, and it was probably one of the things that attracted me to hospitality in general, is mm-hmm. that the stack of technology is just so diverse, mm-hmm. and everything has to talk to each other. In terms of big platforms, I've shifted the PMS three times now. So, and that's probably one of the most horrific things. So the PMS being your primary piece of software, it's got all your guest data, all your profile data, all your reservations and your invoices. So you can imagine when you move that, the whole business is at its knees. And we've moved from an on-prem to, we tried a one cloud provider, it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, again, was during the whole COVID stint. So that flopped on its face.
Why was that out of interest?
There was two problems there. One, it was an international vendor,
mm-hmm.
And they cut back on their resourcing as well. So when COVID hit,
uh-huh.
so they got rid of their entire South African support structure. So we were kind of left on our own to feel our way out. And the software itself didn't have, although it was very good and very modern, and this is where the modern players are still quite a way away from the on-prem guys, is the maturity mm-hmm. of the functionality that you get in the two systems. And that was where, you know, in a hotel group as dynamic and diverse as ours,
mm-hmm.
there just wasn't enough functionality in that for it to become a success across the group.
Yeah. Okay, so you chose another cloud partner.
Then we actually took the cloud partner who were the guys that we were running on-prem, which is Protel.
Mm-hmm.
And we went onto their cloud platform, which is where we're sitting today.
Okay.
Where we're sitting today, yeah.
Okay.
And now, over the last year, we've gone and redone our entire ERP. And if you hear the word ERP, you know you're in for spending money and you're in for sleepless nights. And my hat goes off to the finance guys, because they have had a horrific 18 months trying to get this over the line. And we, We're there. Still a few, you know, things to tighten here and there. And that involved everything from procurement to invoicing to balancing everything into the PMS. So it was a complete, and there's multiple integrations and multiple parties. So
is this also cloud-based or is this an on-prem solution?
All cloud-based. So Dynamics, Microsoft, third-party platform from the UK called Bird Street, another platform for the facilities guys called Prachma, and all of that needs to get weaved in together. Then we built our own middleware.
Oh, wow.
To be able to talk to this, we've got our own. It's actually one of my crown jewels. Let's call it.
Mm-hmm.
Is during the time we devised our own middleware. You know, the feeling that I had was if we were going to do anything amazing with this business, we needed to be the master of that, of that core, and be the one that did the data orchestration between the platforms. And we built this little guy in the middle, and we literally called him Malcolm in the Middle.
Oh, really? That's clever. So you must have quite a big dev team then.
Could be bigger. And I know someone's going to watch this and they go, no, it's big enough. it started out was myself and another guy. So what I basically did is I went headhunting.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't, with the budgets that were allocated, I think the hotel space themselves are quite intimidated when it comes to IT resourcing.
Okay.
IT guys, particularly very senior technicians and programmers and developers, tend to be quite expensive. So we actually, I ended up offshoring it and outsourcing that initial dev. Subsequently, since then, we've now built this up. We've got a team of between 8 to 10 developers there.
Okay.
And we've brought in one of our own. We've now hired up an SDM on our side, so a software development manager, to look after this so that we've, you know, mitigate the risk of having this offshored and obviously having it here, because that team over there is incredible. And I mean, the amount of domain knowledge that we've built up over the last 3-4 years is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to touch on a few specific areas now, and we hinted at the beginning. Let's chat a little bit about artificial intelligence. It's certainly the topic of the moment. Are you using AI, generative AI, at all in your business, and if so, how?
Generative AI specifically, or AI?
No, generative. I just use that example because that's what everyone's doing at the moment. But broadly.
Broadly, so I mean, the reality is we actually have been using it for a while. Okay, and one of the most significant places that initially we started with was in the revenue management.
Mm-hmm.
So we work with another company called Ideas. And in the hospitality space, what you would understand is there's a whole pattern to managing the rate at which a room is sold. There's a whole number of factors, you know, macro and micro factors that one has to take into consideration in order to understand what I should be pricing a room at. And Ideas was one of the, and they, we didn't start with them, we actually started with another business called Pace. And obviously there's a huge amount of artificial intelligence that goes into understanding and taking into all those factors. So it looks at our hotel inventory, it looks at what we've sold before, how we've done, it takes in the macro components and starts to project when we should be selling, how we should be selling, so that obviously the revenue team knows how to manage us across the group, and that feeds then into marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, we obviously, you know, the models have become so accessible, and we play a lot. So with .NET, I'm a .NET boy, so Microsoft. Okay. Microsoft. I mean, when I went to...
No, why you're not running a Mac here.
when I was at RAW, became University of Johannesburg during my tenure there, Microsoft and Standard Bank had a big thing there. So they brainwashed us, you know. And since then, Microsoft all the way. But we've been playing a lot in that space. It's just the Azure suite is just a phenomenal environment. And there's an entire AI studio there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, last I checked, there's about 1,800 different models there to play around with. And we've been doing some very cool stuff with telephones as well.
Okay.
So we've been looking at our central reservations, understanding the phone calls there, converting those phone calls into text, analyzing the entire conversation. And it works incredibly well because you can break the whole thing down. And from that, extract information to understand what people are talking about, what people are not talking about, what things are being missed, how well an agent is adhering to a script, who's selling, who's not selling.
Wow.
And it's and you know that you would normally go and buy that off the shelf, right?
Yes.
And, you know, with a little bit, I've got this incredible team and we just, Altus. You know. Our CEO actually challenged us with this because he had seen it at a colleague of his, and we went and saw what they were doing, and I said, right, give me 2-3 months, and off we went and just reproduced everything that they had. You know, loved the concept. Beyond that as well, we're doing, so in that Malcolm in the middle that I told you about that we built, is in, and this is one of the failings I find with PMSs in general, they don't really build the software to be specific, but I think that's any SaaS-based platform, right?
Yeah.
It can never be as specific as a business needs for it to be, right? So we built this, and I apologize for all the dorky names. I am a nerd by
trade. I love Malcolm in the Middle is brilliant.
So we built this cool little applet we call Joffrey. We affectionately call Joffrey, and I did name it after the Game of Thrones character because I was quite annoyed at the time, right, by it. So I said, cool, I'm going to call you Joffrey. But this
Joffrey was the young king.
Yes, the horrible one. Yes. So we built this. This is not a horrible app, I promise you. So we built this little component, and it actually sits like a parasite inside of the platform, and takes away any of the functionality that doesn't work. We've kind of embedded it, and it allows us to actually inject that in.
Mm-hmm.
But with that there, we're now doing a whole bunch of cool things from an AI perspective. We are injecting, we haven't yet completed it, but we've started taking the guest review information, and we go take the guest review information, we interrogate it, and through a series of prompts, we break down an understanding of what that guest experience is. Then we're able to then feed that in directly into the software, which goes to the staff. So when they arrive, they will see that, you know, here comes Duncan. Mm-hmm. This was Duncan's past experience. It tells you what you should be doing as an improvement. It also takes into consideration what other people's experiences were in that room, you know. And so it kind of preempts and says, you know, the last five people have had a bad Wi-Fi experience as an example. Perhaps you should look at it. Duncan doesn't like this or that. So that's a very cool... I was hoping to have it done this year, but unfortunately, deadline shift, and we'll definitely have it out early next year.
Will AI allow you to do dynamic pricing as well? Is that something that the hotel industry?
Well, that's what I was interested in. Yes, that's what I mentioned we were doing with ideas. That's what the revenue and the rate management.
Sorry,
is doing.
I missed that. So you'd be able to determine through AI that this hotel room is likely to sell if we drop it to this price point in this particular week.
So it's looking exactly, and it's looking. It's looking at. It's taking in our history. So, and that was one of the reasons why we moved to ideas, because of the way their modeling works.
Right.
So it's taking in our current history of what we've done in the past, and the time of year and those components, and then also looking at what was key was looking at what's happening around.
Yes.
And from that, it can obviously suggest, it doesn't, we don't necessarily put it into a complete autopilot, but at least what it's doing is it's giving and inferring those suggestions to the revenue manager or to the GMs, and they're making that decision. And it's been, I mean, that's just game changing for us.
To what extent do you allow the AI to make decisions, and to what extent can the managers fall into the background? I mean, can you have an AI automatically make a decision about the pricing for a room, or does a human being always need to check it?
You still need that person, and I don't know if it's a case of we don't yet want to let the, you know, go of the steering wheel, but we still have that human being. So what it has done is taken all the heavy lifting prior to that point. So it's doing all the calculations prior and inferring it. We do let it make some changes, but it's very much under guidance still.
Okay.
Does that change in future? I think it's inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's inevitable because the reality, what's going to happen is you bidding, let's take, for instance, the whole market, the whole ecosystem that I was explaining to you, where people take their inventory, because that's what you're basically doing, and you're putting it onto the internet and you're distributing that. And that's going onto multiple platforms, which is your booking.com and your Expedia and that. The amount of compute that's going to have to go into changing and manipulating that price, because if everybody starts changing those prices, you're in a ferocious bidding war.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're still waiting for human beings to drive that whilst others are not doing it, I think you're going to be sorely left behind. Very much so. I mean, obviously, as any hotel group will tell you, the push is to get people to book directly, but it's very difficult when you get onto the highway, which is Google, and you start driving, and Google's going to show you their stuff first, you know? Then everybody's fighting for attention there.
Yeah. Fascinating time ahead, I think, as AI increasingly infiltrates, I don't know if that's the right word, infuses itself.
Oh, it has infiltrated, I promise you. It has infiltrated.
I want to ask about security as well, because that's the top of mind, not just in this industry, but across the board. But the hospitality industry obviously deals with a lot of sensitive customer information. You've got guests who are very high profile often, top business leaders, politicians, that sort of thing. How do you deal with, what is your approach to cybersecurity? And what specific measures does the Capital Hotels Group employ in that regard?
100%. So obviously, it's one of the most sensitive things. I mean, you've read countless times how these massive groups, and you can imagine their budgets. We've got a decent budget, but you can imagine their budget is probably ferocious in terms of what they're spending on this. And normally what gets hit in any one of these attacks, it's personal information. Mm-hmm. So for us, it's critical. And we're going through, I think it's a forever process. And I think also with AI now, it's become an incredibly difficult environment too, because the amount of attack that happens and the way that it's changing because of how you can change your attack approach using something like AI has made our jobs significantly harder. Mm-hmm. We are going through a massive process now of trying to even conform to the highest regulations to ensure that we are storing the information correctly. So everything from how our staff take their machines home, what they can connect to, what they can see, can they put a removable drive in, can they log into an account without MFA, can they log in without it being on our domain. We've had to, we've had to increase all those things. I mean, when I came into the business, and I still remember because it's stuck in the back of my mind, our HR officer, John, came to me and he said, this is the culture of the business. We're all grown-ups here and we treat everyone like grown-ups and we give them the computer and we tell them, be responsible. And we've all seen how that movie plays out, right?
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, the biggest breaches, it's always that human component, that human factor that brings in. So, and that's been that is our biggest challenge, is obviously we have 500 to 800 of those human components. And you're talking about, people that are coming from diverse backgrounds. Mm. So not everybody has the understanding, has the necessary skill set to understand what's the right thing and the wrong thing to do. So lots needs to happen and is ongoing in terms of educating cyber awareness, what they should be, what they shouldn't be doing. But I think I'm more of the philosophy of having a complete zero trust. Mm-hmm. I trust no one.
Right.
Trust no one, and you need to do your job. And if you're unable to do your job, then we'll open the door in those areas there. But we need to close it down. Mm-hmm. That's been our big drive at the moment now, just to kind of bring that conformity in there and prevent people from hopping around in between networks.
And how do you go about educating employees about the risks? Are they required to do mandatory training sessions? How do you approach it?
So not yet in full flight.
Okay.
Not yet in full flight. So obviously what we've done is we've done awareness training for your, let's call it management and above, or individuals within the business that carry sensitive information.
Sure.
It's been quite an obstacle to get to the frontline worker, just purely because they are inundated with our own training. We've got our own schooling facility within the business itself, which trains and uplifts the staff in terms of hotel training. Our next big plot is obviously going through and making sure that permeates. So we're going to implement it to the way that if you haven't done your training and you haven't passed it, we actually just close the door down.
Okay.
So immediately if you failed something, you'll come in the next day and it will literally tell you, sorry, you can't do that. But it's purely because you haven't done your training, or you failed.
Mm-hmm.
You failed in the test. And that is typically done in a series of quizzes and questions and things that are sent through videos. And then we also, we're busy partnering now with another business, which will basically do, they'll phone in and they'll try and do spoof attempts. And also it automates as well. So it will send spoof emails and things like that and see who will respond to it. So we can have an identified risk register within the business. And we know where we need to improve.
Right. Now, you obviously need to comply with South African legislation around privacy, and POPI obviously is the legislation in South Africa, but clearly you also have guests from other jurisdictions, including the EU, where GDPR applies. Does that mean you have to comply with GDPR directly?
So what we do is we comply with GDPR.
Okay.
Because
As a matter of course.
Just as a matter of course, because if we comply with GDPR, we naturally comply with POPI. With POPI, yeah.
Okay.
So, and One of the advantages with a lot of the vendors that we do use, particularly they're all European based, and they have got enormous controls around that. So it's been a bit of a saving grace, but we obviously have to enforce our own internal, because we still have a lot of information that moves in between the cells.
Yes.
Between the different faculties of the business, being finance, sales, admin, etc.
Does it make doing business more difficult?
I think it's going to, because obviously I've started introducing this year. This year's drive has been very much, you know, I mentioned zero trust. We've gone and we've changing our entire cybersecurity posture, and I literally am having I'm going to call it a speech in a couple of weeks to the executive to say, guys, the business is changing, and this is not the road we might take or would like to take. This is the road we're taking,
yes.
And it's the one that is going to some degree, make business a little bit tricky, because I know how the interchange of information's been. You know, certain things have been lax, and it's been a little bit easier to not to say that we've opened ourselves up to be victims, but it's been too relaxed that it's too hard to audit, too hard to see, too hard to know if there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that's the issue. You need to know when there's a problem so you can react to it as fast as possible.
Yes. I'd like to talk a bit about skills development and leadership as we move towards the end of the conversation. I know you have some skills development initiatives in place in the group. Maybe just tell us a little bit about those. And you know, we know there's an IT skills shortage in South Africa. How tough is it for you to find the talent you need? And what projects have you specifically put in place to help develop the next generation?
We want to keep that in an IT realm, or kind of
sure.
broadly around the business. So I mentioned the hotel itself has a hospitality school itself. So they do a lot. It's an incredible arm of the business. It does a lot in train. We even have external hotels coming in and bringing their staff there to be trained. Yeah, the IT side has been a little bit trickier. So this year again was a big drive. So I've actually taken the team individually and set it as almost like a milestone for each of them that they have to. Mm-hmm. They have to get into this basis of upskilling themselves in these areas. Where we don't have the skills is, to your point, we obviously then rely quite heavily on third parties.
Mm-hmm.
So we partner with vendors themselves. And sadly, what you said, when you talk about skill shortages, we've had to move, you know, when it comes to networks, because a large portion of what we provide within the hotel is driven on the backbone of a network.
Mm-hmm.
A single hotel like Zimbali or Park as an example, you're talking 400 to 500 access points there across 100 or odd switches. It's an enormous network, okay? We don't have the manpower to go and hire that, and we're not going to. So what we do is we find key partners that have a really good skill set in that, partnered with businesses such as Fortinet, etc., that brings in that resilience.
Mm-hmm.
What we found was that, you know, we didn't typically like to go and shop for those skills at the very big IT companies, because they charge a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not willing to pay the, you know, there's silver, then there's bronze, and then there's gold and platinum. And if you're not willing to play the highest echelon, you get a subpar. You go into the cookie factory, right?
Yeah.
Which means that the support becomes cookie factory. You go into a call center. It didn't work for us. So we've aligned ourselves. We then align ourselves with the small to medium guys.
Okay.
Because there's a stake in there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they'll give you the attention. The problem is the skill shortage there. These guys are flip-flopping and being headhunted.
By the
big guys. Mm. Oh, well, not even just the big guys. The other countries, they love to come. Mm. South Africans are, we're a phenomenal breed. We work incredibly hard. We're suckers for punishment, you know. They come shopping. And you know, in terms of dollar to rand, we're cheap.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So these guys are coming in and poaching these guys left, right, and center. So it's been incredibly difficult to find partners. We've had to move, and we actually are moving again now to another partner. But then in order to mitigate that, what I've done is now internalized, to your point, is I've said, guys, we can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
You know, I'll pour my energy into these guys, make sure that they can be the best that they can be, so we can keep that core competency in here. And we now rely more on them for a shortage of manpower,
mm-hmm.
or when something gets so overly complicated, we need to go to a tier 3 or tier 4 engineer.
Hmm. And do you find international recruitment agencies trying to headhunt your own internal employees as well? Is it, I mean, do you have to actively look after them to ensure they don't get poached, taken
not,
abroad?
Because most of the guys are technicians. So the team, remember that the team is divided into infrastructure and then the software side.
Okay.
We've only recently started building up. The software guys get eaten, you know, they get offers every second day. It's, you know, get me through the glass ceiling every second day of the week. But the infrastructure guys are a little bit different. You know, I've hired guys that obviously love the business, and we obviously try and keep them around. So from an international perspective, I've been lucky in that regard. Senior technicians are the problem. They're the guys on the upper levels and on the software side. They get offers.
Okay.
They get offers. LinkedIn is a shopping ground, you know.
So how do you hang on to them? I mean, how do you ensure you don't lose that top talent?
You have to do your best. Yeah. I mean, and
just make sure
give them an environment that they can thrive in. Mm-hmm. Don't micromanage them at all. You know, I hate micromanaging, and typically when micromanaging happens, something's gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Give them exposure to fail. You know, I think that's one of the greatest things that I've learned from my time at the Capital is failing is the best thing. Okay. As long as you're failing, obviously, in a forward direction. And we've adopted that. You know, you've got to understand that we do things and we're always constantly trying to innovate. And the guys are constantly, you know, doing something, it doesn't work out, and we come together. And I think being in that environment has kept them around. You know, they can see it. And they can see it. And because we don't have this immense or enormous overly sized team, they're important as well. You know, there's a fine line between having the right amounts of staff and then just too much staff. And then you become a guy that works at a bank.
You're right. No offense to the
bankers
who've been on the show. So let's talk lastly then about leadership in IT. What do you believe are the essential qualities of a director of IT, a CIO, CTO in 2024? What's actually required of the job? What makes a good CIO?
What makes a good CIO? I think somebody who listens. Okay, somebody who's not necessarily making all of the decisions. You understand? I understand the environment. I understand the space. I understand what we need to achieve, but I can't get there alone. I understand that I need you, and I need you, and I want you to feel important in the process. So uplifting the guys, you know, that's if you're talking and retaining, it's uplifting the guys.
Yeah.
Making them understand that this is for you. Let's do this. I got your back. You know, let's go and get that. Understanding that. And then the second side of it is knowing that you've got to learn the skills. So in learning the skills, they need the time and they need the backing of the business to say to them, we want you to learn the skills.
Mm-hmm.
We want you. We're going to incentivize it. You know, and that's what I've done this year. And I said to the guys as they were completing all their qualifications, I said, great news. That's amazing. What's next? You know? That's really what it drives. I just finished my own postgraduate now in AI and machine learning. And I was like, yeah, this is amazing. And then I kind of sat back for about a week or two and I thought to myself, what now? You know? And that's one of the things that I love and hate about the industry. And I think it's not going to change anytime soon. You know, maybe in 10 years or so when I decide to hang up my cleats and go and flip hamburgers, it'll be a different job. But coming back to the question, I think those are some of the areas that, you know, and obviously being that conduit for the team, you know, they're stuck in the minutiae, they're stuck in the detail. You know, you need to detach yourself because it gives them the room to move, and detach yourself to go into areas that you can think and bring back that thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily you're not coming there with answers. You're coming there with challenges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing. I've fallen so far away from programming, it's actually embarrassing. Okay. I still understand it. I can still talk to the team when we're talking about algorithms and problems and data issues. I still understand it on that level, but I can't go and I don't know the syntax anymore, you know? So really but what I can add to that is I've got the thinking. I can bring that thinking back, which fuels these guys, and you know, you're pepping them and you're priming them and say, go, that's a great idea, go for it. Go. And you know, we've got you. Don't be scared to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be a chop. Mm-hmm. Okay, don't go out and be reckless. But you know, let's go and do something.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that being a technologist is fundamental to being an IT leader, being a CIO, being someone in IT management? Or do you think someone who's got an accounting background and maybe an MBA could also take on this role successfully?
100%.
Both?
100%. Oh, I don't think, I hate the word, what is a technologist?
Oh, someone like you who grew up with computers and learned to program and can talk to an IT guy about, I don't know, programming code and that sort of thing.
My view, and I actually had this debate because with some of the guys in the business, because there's this constant thing, you know, when I open my mouth and I start to talk, it's like, oh, it's too technical. It's, you know, it's beyond me.
Mm.
And my feeling is that we're all going to have to be, you know, if you think of the current generation, I'm just thinking of my son at home and the way he devours the tablet and the way he's able to consume they are technologists.
Yeah.
Everybody is going to have to be a technologist to some.
Because it's transforming every industry.
It absolutely is. It's seeping in, you know, just the way AI is going to seep in. And, you know, maybe we're going to be living in a Terminator movie from, you know, 10 years from now. I don't know.
Let's hope not.
But everybody. So to your point, you know, when you ask that question is, I think there's room for anybody to come into that role.
Yeah.
The magic comes in, you know, a CIO isn't the CTO, okay? He's not necessarily the CEO. He's not the COO.
Yeah.
He's somebody who understands how useful technology can be, okay? Not afraid to bring it into the business and understands the value that it's going to drive and understands those business layers. You know, it's some way, you know, when I was making the joke about having done marketing and having exposure to business on levels that probably, you know, if my career hadn't taken this weird twist, I wouldn't have. But it's given me such value because when I approach a technology issue, I approach it like an entrepreneur. I approach it like a business with this mind of going, you know, it's not just about the sexiness of what this app's going to do or what it's going to look like, but what it's going to achieve and the impact that it's going to have and how to bring it into the business.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and thanks for giving our audience some insight into the use of technology in the hospitality industry. Jose Suarez is Director of IT at the Capital Hotels, Apartments and Resorts. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central's Meet the CIO. It's much appreciated.
Thank you, Duncan. This has been absolutely awesome. And hopefully I didn't offend anybody there.
Especially not the bankers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. Thank you so much.
Much appreciated.
Okay.